Good afternoon. I'm going to call the committee to order, even though we do not have a quorum. It is deadline week, and so things are kind of difficult here at the Minnesota House. So hopefully we'll be getting some members soon. So we're going to pick up with the agenda. Since the first couple of bills are bills that we were just hoping to move out quickly, and we cannot do that, in order to efficiently use our time, we're going to call up House File 154, Representative Hewitt. You are here, yeah. And see if we can, because we are going to take some testimony on that bill, and so I want to get started with our testimony, and then when we get more members in the room, we can probably, when we take care of this bill, then we can probably revert to some of our others. So House File 154, welcome to the committee, Representative Hewitt, if you'd like to introduce yourself and introduce your, and the chair will move House File 154 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS omnibus bill. Go ahead, please.
Madam Chair and committee, thank you for hearing my bill today. This is a very important bill, and this service that we're talking about today touches everyone throughout the state as it involves the 8 regional EMS programs. We're asking for $100,000 for each of them for the biennium. The 8 regional EMS programs are currently funded at $146,000 per biennium, and they receive 90% of that through seatbelt fines. With the passengers of the primary seatbelt law, funding the regional EMS programs has diminished dramatically, so stop wearing your seatbelts. So I'm going to turn it over to them real quick so we can keep in matter of time here. But I have several testifiers here, and I'm going to have them introduce themselves as they go.
All right, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair, committee members, I'm Don Hauge. I'm the executive director of the Southeast Minnesota EMS, the chairwoman's home district, so we're happy to be here, and thank you for listening to us. In the Southeast District, we're quite busy with opioid making sure that our first responders and law enforcement have opioid medications such as Narcan. We're doing the training for them and making sure they've been given the Narcan, and we've had several uses of that Narcan for life-saving measures of opioid overdose. I believe right now, this past 2 years, we've given out over 600 doses of Narcan to our first responder agencies. We also have a medical direction consortium, which is very important to our district. We provide medical direction for 35 first responder groups and 17 ambulance services. By statute, each ambulance service has to have a medical director. So without this consortium, the ability to find a medical director in the rural setting is very difficult. Most of our medical directors live into the metro type areas. So we provide that medical direction for those ambulance services, and without our current service of medical direction consortium, some of those ambulance services might be forced to shut down, at least for a short period of time. So we provide education to all those services as well. So thank you for hearing us today.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. Another testifier?
Madam Chair, members, my name is Jill Rorett. I'm the Executive Director of the Metropolitan Emergency Services Board. We are the EMS region for a 10-county metro region. Like the Southeast region, we do have an opioid program as well. We also are actively involved in planning and in response for large-scale events. We were very active for the Super Bowl last year. We'll be doing some work with the Final Four coming up as well. And we also support the ambulance strike teams statewide. So if or when it starts flooding up north, which is likely, we will also be sending teams to go and help help there with response up there to supplement the local resources.
All right, thank you. Please.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Tom Vanderwall with Greater Northwest EMS. We're based out of Bemidji. We cover the 12 counties in the northwest corner. And we're preparing today up in Detroit Lakes and Thief River Falls, getting prepared for mass exodus of patients from hospitals, nursing homes, things like that, doing that active exercise to be ready for our annual 500-year flood. So those are the types of things that the EMS systems provide as a backbone, a network and a fabric that supports those local EMS agencies. Simple things like making sure that the responders themselves, several of them in our region this last winter, were sick. Guy ended up in the emergency room because of carbon monoxide poisoning. Simple little project we're doing is getting carbon monoxide detectors on the first in bags for every single first responder group that shows up, keeping their safety. We do a lot of interaction with the other regional programs, so it's a coordinated collaborative effort. As you can see, there's a unified front with the metro and the rural on most all of our EMS components. It's a system. We are to be system builders, and that's the important part of it. Other than that, I really thank you very, very much for hearing this bill and moving it forward today. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Tony Spector, and I'm the Executive Director of the State Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board, also known as the EMSRB. We are essentially the grantor to the AEMS regional grantees. I want to just give a brief background on our support for this bill. There are essentially two grants that fund the AEMS regions. One is what is known as the support grant, and that is a $585,000 per year grant that is divided equally among the EMS regions. That amounts to $73,125 per region per year. Supplementing or augmenting that grant is what is known as the seatbelt funding or the relief grant. That is funding that comes directly from seatbelt citations. The challenge with that grant is that we've seen a precipitous, the challenge with that grant generally is that trying to plan a budget based upon an estimate of fine amounts that is not an exact science can be challenging. Amplifying that challenge is that over the recent years, we've seen a precipitous decrease in the funding source from the citations because we see an increase in seatbelt use throughout the state. I believe we are approximately 95% compliant throughout the state, and that's a static number for the past few years, and that's great. But of the remaining 5%, we are also seeing, I believe, a decrease in law enforcement citations issued for seatbelt offenses. We are also seeing a decrease in law enforcement traffic stops related to traffic offenses. So taking all of that panoply together, we're seeing a decrease in funding. To put things in perspective, fiscal year 2016, each region received a little over $94,000. Fiscal year 17, $89,000. Fiscal year 18, $76,000. These are those seatbelt numbers. And fiscal year 19, we are on track for the lowest ever. And so for the partnership that the EMS Regulatory Board has with the AEMS regions, it can be challenging for the regions and the board for the regions to continue to do the good work that they do when they are seeing their funding source dwindle and they have really essentially no control over it. And so for those reasons, the EMSRB supports this bill and asks that this bill pass. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that explanation. We appreciate it. Representative Hewitt, do you have other testifiers?
Madam Chair, I believe that is it.
Okay. Any questions from members? Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and guests. I represent here. I totally agree that we need to make sure we have a good EMS system. All of us depend on having our local response teams, wherever we are in the state, be accessible and trained and well-equipped to do things. I noted in your bill, and it sounds like it's been the tradition to divide whatever appropriation is available equally. And I'm wondering if that creates a scarcity in some areas of the state where they maybe have to use much more volunteers and, you know, have much more limited opportunities for training in their own area. And then if it under supports complicated areas like the metro where you have competing ambulance services, lots more first responders of all types to coordinate. And has there been any discussion about whether or not that equal division really means some aren't able to meet their needs.
Representative Hewitt?
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, I've never heard so much about equalization in my life before coming to the legislature. So I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Vanderwald here, who has been in EMS as long as I have, and let him kind of answer that. I think he can give you a little history to why they do it the way they do.
Mr. Vanderwald.
Chair Liebling and representatives, to answer your question regarding that, so many of us rural regional systems are primarily volunteer, and within the metro, a lot of it is a for-profit business model. So the intent and the spirit of the creation of the regional EMS systems originally basically began with Representative Bob Anderson way back in the late 80s. And primarily the intent was to ensure that that local first responder group, that local volunteer ambulance service, and those types of individuals were able to get some form of infrastructure support to make sure that they're represented at the legislature like we are here, have somebody that can help them secure training, have someone that can help them ensure that we get feedback, do pilot projects, try new things, without them having to experiment on their own and that type of thing. As far as trying to keep some form of equalization with it, many of us regional programs do a lot of statewide activities together. Like Don mentioned, it's the opioid crisis, getting out the Narcan naloxone. How do you train the first responders? Who are the ones that are going to receive it? Who determines those priorities? The regional EMS system, along with the MSRB, and then this body representing the legislature, are that backbone and that hidden spirit of where this is coming from. So that first responder individual that is a full-time job out down at the body shop can do that to make a living and provide some service, public service for his community.
All right. Thank you for that. Okay, so now that we do have a quorum, and so the chair will officially move that House File 154 be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS omnibus/division bill. We've kind of used a different terminology here as we've gone along. So the bill is laid over. Thank you, Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for that.
Okay.
Do you want the next bill?
Representative Hewitt, I think, since we have a quorum, the next thing we're going to do is entertain a motion to approve the minutes. Representative Cantrell moves to approve the minutes of March 7th, 2019. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The minutes are approved. Thank you. Well, let's see. Okay. Representative Hewitt, since we have you there, we'll do your next bill. The chair will move that House File 155 be laid over for possible inclusion. And you have one testifier on that one, I think?
I do, madam.
This is not on the committee.
Chair.
Welcome to the committee. Representative Hewitt, do you want to go ahead and introduce this bill?
I do. Madam Chair and members, House File 155, this bill here has personally touched everybody in this room at one time or another. It really touched me when I was working on the ambulance and my job was to go out and pick up the sick of the sick. And basically we would go all over the state and with our ambulance and bring them back to the metro area for an upper level care. When we got there many times before this program was created, a lot of patients were not stabilized. The ERs were not equipped to do what they had to do. They weren't trained. And when we saw this program hit the street, it was unbelievable. Not only did it put me out of business, it helped the local ambulance services. Actually, these people became more stabilized in the ER. They were able to take them on their own. They didn't have to bring people in from the metro. So this is a great bill, and I thank the legislators for this because this came out of this body. And it's still going today, and I ask for your support, and I have a great testifier with me today. Go ahead and introduce yourself.
All right. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Thank you, committee members. My name is Paul Lakeman. I am the Executive Director of the Comprehensive Advanced Life Support Program, otherwise known as CALS, a 501c3 nonprofit organization focusing on providing critical care training for our over 50 critical care hospitals throughout the state. First, let me thank you, the members of the Minnesota Legislature, for your support of the CALS program over the years. It has made a vital difference in the care of individuals in our rural communities who do not have immediate access to critical, potentially life-saving critical care services. Without that support, we would not be able to provide the training to physicians, physicians' assistants, advanced practice nurses, nurses, and paramedics, who regularly are called on to assess an injury or illness and determine the right course of treatment. The decision often results in life-saving measures that stabilize a patient for transport to a trauma center or intensive care, and often assists the patient in final stages, and that institution, I should say, often assists the patient in the final stages of recovery when they are returned to their community for care before going home. Over the past 2 years, your additional support has allowed us to begin adapting the CALS program to meet the current educational and training needs of our rural hospitals. Our course is currently a 2.5-day lecture, didactic, and hands-on skills learning experience. Taking staff away from their responsibilities for that long, however, puts financial and staffing burdens on these small critical care hospitals who operate on razor-thin margins and challenging staffing issues. We often have class participants cancel their anticipated attendance at the last minute because institutional staff needs are unable to be accommodated without them. And even if they can be accommodated, it puts a strain on the already stretched financial resources of those institutions as they compensate the staff who attend and also have to compensate the replacements for covering their shifts. Thanks to your support over the last 2 years, as well as assistance from outside foundations, we have begun to develop the program into an online learning experience for a didactic lecture part of the course. This online component of the instruction can be completed at home at the student's own pace. And once they've completed and tested to this portion of the program, they will be eligible to attend a 1 day or 1.5 day hands-on skills training to complete their most essential part of the CALS course. In rural hospitals with limited staffs, that essential part is teamwork, and it becomes critical to the successful patient outcomes as those institutions have limited resources. The result of this course revamping will reduce the actual time away from 2.5 days to 1 day, easing the burdens for students and institutions both financially and from a staffing perspective. In 2017, the legislature agreed to increase our traditional grant. Now, I have to make a correction here. In the testimony I provided, it was $450,000. The actual number is $408,000, so my apologies to that. $408,000 to $508,000. We are respectfully requesting today that additional $100,000 become an annual part of the CALS grant support. It is critical not only to the CALS, but more importantly to the over 50 critical care access hospitals in the state and to the thousands of patients they care for who require the skills of trained medical professionals to quickly get them to critical services they need so they can return to their families and their communities. I appreciate your time this afternoon, and I'll be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Right. Thank you very much for your testimony. Are there questions for members? All right. Not seeing any. Representative Hewitt, any final word?
Madam Chair, again, thank you for hearing this bill today, and we would hope that you can look at supporting this. This is a critical key to our success here in Minnesota for our hospitals. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. So with that, House File 155 is laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you. We're going to return now to the top of our agenda and call up House File 85, Representative Brand. And the chair will move that House File 85 be recommended for re-referral to Ways and Means. Mm-hmm. And Representative Brand's bill is here because there was concern. I think it kind of made it all the way through, right? And then there was concern about a potential fiscal note. This is a bill that members, I think, should be fairly familiar with. First of all, it was a Clark Johnson bill way back when and made it all the way through. I think it was in Omnibus Prime, if I'm not mistaken, and was vetoed. And we did have a hearing in, I know it was heard in policy. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I know a lot of members are familiar with it, maybe not everybody, but Representative Brand, we have in front of us essentially a zero fiscal note for the bill.
Right.
But could you just give members, because we're going to vote this bill out, just give members a really short little summary of what the bill does, if you would.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having me today to talk about House File 85. What it basically does is authorize the patient-assisted medication for EMTs, AEMTs, paramedics that are certified under the Minnesota statute. They show up, they get a call, they show up on scene. You've got a person that's dealing with medical emergency associated with a rare disease. There's a member in my community, or at least in my constituency, that is a 9-year-old girl, Bailey Johnson. You might have remembered her from policy committee when she testified a few weeks ago. She's got a rare disease. It's an adrenal deficiency, and so sometimes her adrenal glands don't produce enough adrenaline. And rather than having her go all the way to the hospital to have a doctor administer those life-saving drugs, EMTs, AMTs, and paramedics can actually do that on site. And we're not talking about a golden hour. We're talking about golden minutes with some of these rare diseases. And so it's really important that we have this and address this. It's already been through the first hearing in the Senate, of course, the hearing in the House as well. It's on its way. It was bipartisan support last year, so I'm hoping we can get it this year. We've got bipartisan authorship on the bill, and I really appreciate that. And it is worth noting for everybody to hear that. And I look forward to your support today.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Brand. Are there any questions for members? Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to highlight, I think it's been years since I've seen a fiscal note that says the agency can absorb the costs within it. And it's. I just want to compliment them on that.
Right. Thank you, Representative Loeffler. All $5,000 a year. So it is good. And Representative Brand, thank you for persisting in this and carrying it, and to all the members who are co-sponsoring it, because this is – this is such a no-brainer once you realize that we didn't have this in place, and, you know, we can save more lives with this, and this is just something that seems like we should be doing it. So thank you. So seeing no further discussion, the chair will renew her motion that House File 85 be referred to Ways and Means. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Brandt.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Representative Kotsia Watoon, House File 825. Welcome to the committee. So, first of all, members, this one's a little bit different because we have a, we're supposed to have a division report. Okay, so apparently we don't have in our packets. This is a bill that's been heard in the Early Childhood Division, which is a subdivision of this division.
That's correct.
And so it's really coming to us as a division report. And then the reason this one's in sort of an unusual posture, because this needs to, rather than being laid over in this committee, this one needs to be re-referred to Ways and Means, and from there it's going to the Jobs Committee, I understand.
That's correct.
This is really, this is not a bill that's going to end up in the HHS. Oh.
Barb came in and it's been.
And, oh, yes. And, well, first of all. Okay, well, first of all, we need to adopt the division report, and we don't have the division report. So Patrick has gone to find the division report. So, sorry, Representative, but I think we're going to need to lay it over for just a few minutes while we get that, because
sure.
We don't have, you know, I can't really ask members to vote to adopt something that we don't have in front of us. So if you wouldn't mind, we're going to lay this over for a few minutes until we get that
okay.
In order. Thank you.
That's fine, Madam Chair. Does the same go for 908, or do we want to move to that one?
Representative, that's also a division report,
okay.
So we don't have, I don't believe that's here either. So, well, We're supposed to adopt the division report. So if you don't mind, we're going to just wait a few minutes. Patrick is going to get that in order. It's really pretty much is a formality, but I think we have to observe the formality. So sorry about that. So we're gonna lay this one over, and then we'll take them both up, and hopefully they'll be very quick when we do get to them.
Great. Thank you.
All right. In the meantime, while we're waiting to deal with that, we're going to call up House File 1169, Representative Purcell. And the chair will move that House File 1169 be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS bill. And members, this is a bill that had an informational hearing on February 14th. If you remember, there was another bill for White Earth Nation that was the same bill, essentially, just for a different group. And so I think we should be able to take this and lay it over without probably a lot of concerns here. But I certainly want to give Representative Purcell just a moment to remind us what the bill is and then take any questions from members. So, Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Yeah, it is a rare opportunity when you have such a good bill that you get a hearing in the same committee twice. So thank you for that. We did talk about this, and you may recall that we had testifiers from the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe. We do not today have testifiers. But this $1.6 million is for the Leech Lake Band, their Department of Human Services, to take care of, as it were, the Indian Child Welfare Act children that are in need of those services. So similarly to, as you indicated, Madam Chair, the White Earth Band of Ojibwe White Earth Tribe has a similar grant opportunity, and there's efforts. I won't digress too far, but there's efforts to make this statewide with all of the tribes. So it's a pretty brief bill, as you can see. That's what it's for, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Purcell. Are there any questions for members? All right. Seeing none, so the chair will renew her motion that House File 1169 be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS bill. Thank you, Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Okay, we are unfortunately still waiting for the division report, so we will move to Representative Neuer. I think that is the only other bill on our agenda today. So okay, so we will call up House File 1981. And Representative Neuer, if it's okay with you, I know you have a bill that we want to take more testimony on and so on, and we may have more discussion. If we get those division reports you're waiting for, we may lay over your bill for a few moments to take up that other bill so that we don't keep Representative Kotsia-Watun here for the whole...
Madam Chair, Representative Kotsia-Watun just stepped out. So okay. Just so you know, she's close.
All right. Thank you, Representative Acomb. I appreciate that. Okay. Representative Neuer moves that House File 1981 be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS bill. So, Representative Neuer, welcome, and please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. House File 1981 will increase funding for local public health grant by $16 million per year. The local public health grant is a state main investment in services mandated by local public health by the state statute 145A. It provides flexible funding to local governments so they can direct funding to address specific needs in their communities. Local public health services are funded by a combination of federal, state, local dollars. Local tax levies have increased the burden for those localities, meeting the state-mandated community expanding needs. The over-reliance of levies, unstable grants, and series of funding cuts has stressed the local public health systems, limiting capacity to carry out core services and respond to emerging public health issues like opioid, infectious diseases, disparities, and social determinants of health, including the booming of e-cigarettes used by teens, infectious diseases like TB and measles, and natural disasters. Investing in prevention services through local public health pays off by saving healthcare and other public health programs. This bill will help to restore local public health capacity to maintain state-mandated services, respond to local needs, and relieve the local tax levies. Members, this is a bill that I have gone through the process of looking the research that we're required to go through. So addressing the public health needs is a critical issue. Addressing the chronic illnesses and diseases will reduce the cost of healthcare in general. With that, I just wanted to introduce Amy Karen, who will testify on behalf of this bill.
All right. Thank you, Representative Neuer. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. My name is Amy Karen. I'm the administrator of Dodge Steel Community Health Board and also the chair of the local public health association. I'm here on behalf of our members who are leaders across the state in local public health. I'm present here today to give you a snapshot of the realities facing our local public health agencies and how critical the local public health grant is to our work. House Bill 1981 supports a statewide increase in funding for the local public health grant, which provides our flexible funding to local governments so they can address critical needs in their communities. The current funding assists in carrying out mandated services outlined in State Statute 145A, which is the Public Health Act. But it only accounts for about 6% of our total local public health expenses. So it's a very small portion of our overall budget. This is a drop in the bucket and consequently transfers the heavy burden on local tax levy dollars to pick up those expenses that can't be covered by other grants or fees. Our local public health agencies serve all citizens pre-birth until death. We have a pulse on the health issues within our communities, and we strive to prevent negative impacts. Local public health is the front line in identifying and stopping the spread of disease, assuring access to health services for all people, responding to health emergencies, and that's just to name a few. The citizens of Minnesota not only rely on a healthy place to live, work, and play, but expect it. So we must rise to those expectations. Unfortunately, over the past 15 years, we have seen a slow crumbling of our local public health infrastructure. This has led to dire consequences to most of our very most vulnerable populations in Minnesota. We're seeing trends go up in infectious diseases, particularly sexually transmitted diseases. We're also seeing an uptick in mental illness. So we're serving a larger amount of people who seem to be falling through the cracks. We're seeing trends of drug and alcohol use rise. And for the past two consecutive years here in the United States, we've seen our average life expectancy go down. And it's down to 78.7 years as the average. So as quoted in a recent article by Centers for Disease Control, the consequences are dire. Not only more death and illness, but also escalating health care costs, a sicker workforce, and a less competitive economy. So future generations may pay the greatest price. This should be cause for alarm and unacceptable in our state. The local public health grant is a lifeline for local public health and the people of Minnesota. We can't continue to operate as we have on a shoestring budget. This bill is critical in protecting and future citizens of this great state. So thank you for your time today.
All right. Thank you very much. Are there other testifiers, Representative Neuer?
I don't have any other testifiers, but I just wanted to see if there is an additional person who is going to testify. No, I don't
is
have
Is there anyone in the room that wants to testify on the bill? Okay, questions from members. All right. I have a question to the testifier. So, and maybe I missed this. I'm sorry if I did. But, you know, there's how do you arrive at the number that's in the bill? Can you kind of give us a little more specifics about, you know, and how, what that would, I don't know if you can, how specific you can be about what can we buy for that additional funding?
Well, there was a study done by the University of Minnesota School of Public Health in 2011 that tried to address looking at those gaps. And I don't know if I can tell you exactly what that would buy. I can tell you we'll have more services for more people in Minnesota. And like I said in my testimony, there are people falling through the cracks. We know that they're out there. And this would just be able to obviously help more people in our state that we're not catching. But there is kind of an extensive study that they did do just to show even investing another $6.30-some per person in Minnesota would help things extremely preventative-wise. I mean, we really look on the preventative side of things in public health. And with our rising health care costs, I think something needs to be done.
All right. Thank you. Representative Noor, did you want to add to that?
Madam Chair, members, visiting with Hennepin County and also the city of Minneapolis, they're really understaffed. And I can give you an example when we had the measles outbreak. They were overwhelmed that they could not tackle the enormous work that needed to be done. So if we had the resources, that they were resourced there well enough, that will have ensured a lot of preventative measures, and that will have created the addressing the social determinants of health and ensuring that they have good culturally competent staff, which right now I think they're struggling, most of them, to provide that kind of services. And that's something which I think this bill will bring Hennepin County and others in the city to be able to find qualified individuals who can address public health issues.
Okay, thank you. And also, and I don't know, Ms. Karen, if you're the right person to ask this of, but we here in Minnesota, we do our public health kind of differently than most states, I think. And we are not just a state-funded system. And I think you addressed this, that the money comes from a lot of different sources. And I just want to kind of, can you talk about that at all? And if you can't, maybe somebody else in the room can. Like, what does it mean for us that we have that difference of how our funding stream is handled in the state? Because, you know, I mean, I know that we are kind of locally focused here, but it does come with some downsides, obviously, right? Ms. Karen.
Yes, Chair Liebman. We do operate similar to some other states and differently from other states. So as you alluded to, there are some states that simply do the local services or provide the local services through their state department. Here we're really fortunate how we are set up in public health. We're fortunate enough to have local public health work hand-in-hand with our Department of Health. So those funds do trickle down to us, which we're very fortunate. We feel like at the local level we have a good pulse on what some of those health gaps are out there. I think we know our community members well, and we keep tabs on that. So I think it's very fortunate we can, although we work mostly in preventative work, we can also keep track of things that may pop up like emerging issues and get on top of those right away.
Okay, very good. Any questions for members? Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I think that, you know, one of the advantages that we have of a local public health system as opposed to a state-administered system is I think of local public health as the conveners, and that when there's an outbreak, whether it's a sexually transmitted disease, it's increased opioid deaths, it's measles outbreak, there's no way our state agency would have the ability to respond. And even in Hennepin County, when we had the measles outbreak, where one individual who was exposed in another country came back, and 3,000 people were potentially exposed and had to be contacted. We've heard testimony in one of the committees here this year that it cost the Department of Health almost $1 million to respond to that, and they said very clearly that did not include the local public health costs. And I know that even in Hennepin, as large as its staff is in public health, had to pull people from other departments in the county to be able to respond as quickly as was needed. And when issues arise and they're paying attention to what's going on and the trends, they're the ones who get together, the hospital administrators and the primary care practitioners, and saying, we're seeing this happening. And are you seeing this in your patient load? And what can we do to better educate the public about these risks? And, I mean, I just got a report from a group that visited with me in my office, and I thought, oh, I'm going to call my local public health department to see if they'll do some outreach. And it was a listing of public schools and daycares in my area that are many of them eight times past the level of vaccination that would provide protection for the children in those classrooms. And I thought, somebody's got to get out to these schools and make sure that the parents there are making informed choices and know what the risks are to the other children in those schools. And so they're the kind of group that you can call, and they will respond. They'll reach out to those local partners. And while the counties, I think, have stepped up with property taxes, the fact that we only provide 6% of the funds, none, I believe, of our federal prevention block grant funds goes to them. I think this is something we should think about.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. I've got Haley and then Hamilton. Representative Haley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just trying to understand the funding stream a little bit more, if you can indulge me for a minute. We awarded, I think, $22 million in 2019, and so you're asking for an additional $16 million each year. That's a substantial increase. So I guess I'll follow up some on the Chair's question on, I'm just trying to be clear, that's a lot of money. We have a lot of needs in this committee. You also talked about local county and city levies picking up what you consider a gap here. So if we award this money, will local levies decrease? And then the second part of my question is, I'd like you to talk about how do the local entities apply for these grants? Are we assured that this gets spread evenly across the state? Are there certain cities that get more than others? If you can address those two questions, I'd appreciate it.
Ms. Karen?
Yes. Liebling. I can't answer that to a certain point. We would hope that, yes, the local tax levies would decrease if we were to get the $16 million each year on top of the base funding that we currently have. We have been operating under some really low funds over the last 15 or so years. It's not kept up with our demands. And you did ask about applying for grants. These funds go to the Department of Health. Our local public health boards then apply for those grant funds through Minnesota Department of Health on a competitive basis, and they're distributed that way. Usually, under this particular grant, it's usually distributed population-wise. So,
Representative Haley? All right. Representative Hamilton?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is added to the base. My question is, what percentage does the department keep for admin costs to simply cut the check and send it out to the counties?
I don't know if Ms. Karen could answer that. Is there somebody here from MDH who could answer that? Ms. Finnegan, thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Melissa Finnegan. I'm the Legislative Director at the Department of Health. Representative Hamilton, you caught me out. I don't know that number off the top of my head, but I can certainly contact staff back at the office and get back to you with an answer.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Finnegan. Okay. All right. Seeing no other questions, the Representative Newark can renew his own motion that House File 1981 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. So the bill is laid over. Thank you, Representative Newark. Thank you. All right, Representative Coatsia-Watoon. Sorry about the missteps here. The chair will move House File 8. Well, the chair will move adoption of the division report from early childhood on House File 825. So all those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. and the motion prevails. The committee report is adopted. So we now have House File 825, and the chair will move that House File 825 be recommended to be re-referred to Ways and Means. And there is also an author's amendment in our packets, the A1, and so the chair will move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape in which the author would like it. All those in favor of the A1, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So, Representative Coatsio-Attune, do you want to just give us a very short explanation of your bill and just tell us what's in the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, absolutely. So HF 825 is a grant for Women Venture. They are a wonderful organization that works with female entrepreneurs specifically in the metro area, but also across the state. And actually my amendment was to remove the word urban from this bill, because as we have kind of begun the process and discussed really what we need in the child care industry here in the metro area as well as in greater Minnesota, it seems like they have capacity to work with community organizations to do a pilot across or outside of the metro area. So we're really excited about that. And essentially they work with low-income women to pool funding. They provide loans that are repaid, and for women who have barriers to entry into the child care industry. So if you're low income, you don't own property, it's very hard to start a home-based child care business. And this is something that they're looking to get a little bit more information on, specifically in more rural areas, so that we can pilot it across the state and help to stem some of the child care crisis that we have here in Minnesota.
All right. Thank you very much. Are there questions for members? Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Coatsio-Attune, was that okay? Tell me a little bit about the rural areas that you know of. I'm trying to picture this in somewhere in greater Minnesota. It doesn't connect with me. Can you share with the committee some examples of where this might be in greater Minnesota?
Yes, absolutely.
Representative Coatsio-Attune.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Baker. So at Women Venture, they're aware of the program that had taken off in the Detroit Lakes area. So it's a pod-based model, and this is sort of modeled after that. And they have very close ties. Women Venture has very close ties in the St. Cloud area. So after our dual early childhood and jobs and economic development committee hearing that we had in St. Cloud a couple of weeks ago, we're exploring the potential of running the pilot in that area. But I know it is potential for other areas as well. So this just removes the stipulation that it had to take place in an urban setting and opens up, allows them to work with some of those community organizations that they have connections with already.
Thank you.
All right. Other questions for members? Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to note that I think Representative Coatsio-Attune is being super polite, so I just wanted to have a chance to let us all know how to pronounce your name, so if we may. Representative?
Thank you. That's Coatsio-Attune.
Thank you. You could probably tell I was sort of avoiding trying to pronounce it, which I'm sure I'm not the only one.
Not at all, Madam Chair. This morning, Chair Mahoney just threatened to call me Rep. CKW. I said that's what my friends call me, and he said, and I said that he could be my friend, and he said that I needed new friends.
Okay. That might be TMI for us. So, okay, well, with that, I will renew my motion that House File 825, as amended, be recommended for re-referral to Ways and Means. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you. All right, Representative Coatsio-Attune on House File 908. So the chair will move adoption of the division report from the Early Childhood Finance and Policy Division on House File 908 to get it before the committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails. And the chair will move that House File 908 be recommended for re-referral to Ways and Means. Representative Katiza Watun, would you like to discuss 908?
Certainly. Thank you, Madam Chair. So this is an additional grant for Women Venture to provide childcare business training free of charge to women who are looking to enter the childcare industry. We know that many people who enter the childcare industry, specifically in the private sector, they do so because they love children, they want to be around children, they potentially want to stay home with their own children or grandchildren, and they don't always have the business background to make sure that things can continue running and that they can be successful in business. So essentially, they are working to create a web-based as well as in-person training program to facilitate the kind of all of the startup expansion operation training that women specifically would need to succeed in the childcare industry.
All right, thank you. Question from Representative Kunesh-Badi.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative. This isn't so much a question as an affirmation of this proposal. I did in-home child daycare for 5 years, and I wish something like this was there to guide me through that whole process. I kind of fell into it, you know, when you're home with your own children for a bit, all of a sudden everybody's looking at you like, hey, would you like to watch my kid? And so it sort of grew into a real business, and it certainly supported me and my children during a time when I really, really needed it. But I know that I struggled a lot with paperwork. There are forms both at the state and different levels, laws that you have to prescribe to. Your home has to be just so. You can only have this kind of a crib and not that kind of a crib. And so if there was something like this in place at that time, it would have made my job a lot easier. And so I want to commend you and thank you for doing this, because I think, as you said, there's a real crunch on licensed daycare providers, both in the metro area and especially out in the great part of Minnesota. And if we have this sort of support and the finances available to start, because it is an investment and it's an invasion sometimes of your own private space, then I think it would be a really great thing to do. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not saying there isn't a need for this, but my impression is that there are some entities that already are offering this. I think through our two-year programs and through some nonprofit organizations that are involved in the childcare space, some of which combine business training with child development and other aspects that are equally or more important in terms of childcare. And so I'm wondering if, as this moves ahead, if you might be interested in thinking about a more traditional state approach, which is a competitive grant. Where those that are doing this can apply to DEED if that's where ultimately it's funded, and then they can just sort through who they think is best qualified to meet this need. And I'm not saying that Women Venture wouldn't do a good job. I just don't know what their experience is in this, but I do think it's good for us when we can to create an open playing field for all that are trying to help meet this need.
Hey, Representative Katiza Watun, do you want to respond?
Certainly. I would be open to discussing the possibility of that. Women Venture has been working in this industry for the past few years. They've had one cohort through the program in the HF 825, and they're seeing a lot of really wonderful success specifically in the wages. I mean, we know that the childcare industry pays quite low wages, and it's difficult for people to work in that industry and stay in that industry. They're seeing some of their cooperative and pod models paying upwards of $20 an hour, which is really exciting. And I would certainly would be interested in discussing that possibility. Thank you.
All right, Representative Loeffler.
And just one last comment. I would hope that the business model is not just say no to child care assistance program subsidized children, which is under the purview of this committee. It doesn't reward people. As well as some families are able to pay independently on their own that are a higher income. But our lowest income families, it's their only access into child care oftentimes. So it's not all just about the money, or it's balancing out those who can pay higher with those who are unfortunately on underpaid state programs.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Seeing no further questions, the chair will renew her motion that House File 908 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you. Thanks for your patience,
absolutely,
Representative Katiza Watun, and sorry again for mispronouncing your name multiple times.
Quite all right. Thank you.
Okay. So, members, that completes our agenda for today. We are half hour ahead, and I'm very happy about that because I know you're all extremely busy with the deadline this week. So I appreciate your moving this through. I have not forgotten anything here, have I, in terms of what we need to do. So.
That's great.
Yep, we did it. All right, so we are adjourned.